You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Family Business by Willem Marx. Oren often messaged models on the same social media platforms, like Instagram and Facebook, that he and Tal used to build their business. Some of the women believed that Oren kept screenshots of their communication with him as leverage to throw back in their faces if they ever accused him of anything untoward. In one civil suit filed late last year in Colorado, a woman alleged Elon had raped her in Aspen as a 17-year-old, then minutes later opened her phone, followed himself on Instagram from her account, then sent himself a message, as if from her, that read, "Hey, babe." The Facebook messages that Maria Sisko received in April 2014 were unusually direct, though Oren was kind of handsome and friends with others she knew from the Miami party scene. "I leave to L.A. on Saturday, but let's meet before," he wrote to the Polish-American model and cardiac nurse. After a brief back and forth, Sisko agreed to have dinner that week with the courteous stranger who invited her to Zuma, a high-end Japanese restaurant. Sisko was surprised when she arrived the following night to find two other men and nine women at Oren's table. She assumed they were going on a traditional date, just the two of them. He was flirty and touchy throughout dinner as he fed her sushi, winking and smiling, but not really engaging in actual conversation. The other women barely spoke, but Sisko decided to accompany Oren and several fellow diners to another party, hoping to get to know him better. When Sisko, Oren, and the others arrived at the Versace mansion, a security guard took her phone and warned there could be no photos before directing the group to a poolside patio area with catering but no music. Oren vanished. But Elon soon arrived, jumping into the water nude and yelling at women around the pool to join him. When nobody accepted his invitation, Elon exited angrily, dried himself off, and got dressed as Oren reappeared by Suska's side. He asked if she wanted to check out the view from the building's tower. "You can see it in the assassination of Gianni Versace, American crime story," and they ascended its narrow staircase. Sisko still hoped for a romantic moment, maybe a kiss at the top. Instead, as she entered the small space with no lights or furniture, Oren's charm vanished, aggression in its place. An athletic 27-year-old tennis player, she struggled as he tried to rip down her dress and expose her breast, pushing her to the ground. Then he yanked her underwear to her knees, masturbated, and penetrated her without a condom or her consent, she says. Sisko yelled for help and told him repeatedly to get off, but Oren only grunted and told her to shut up again and again. "I was afraid of him," she says, recalling the pain and how his weight drove her into the hard floor. "I was just fighting for my life. I just wanted him to release me," she says. "I just wanted to get out of there as fast as possible." Oren pulled out and ejaculated on her chest, smirking as he said, "Oh, that was good," then stood up, zipped up his pants, and left, like nothing happened, she says. He never contacted her again. Sisko says she experienced nightmares and flashbacks, took months off work, stopped going out, and spent years in therapy. She recently told her mother about what happened, as well as the FBI and a Miami police detective, but has not moved forward with civil charges. It was very hard for me, because I felt guilty for not coming forward, but also felt guilty for holding it in, she says now. I thought that he was evil. He's a monster. But I also thought that maybe I'm the only one. She wasn't. A couple years after Suska says she was raped, a message popped up on the Instagram account of another model who had recently moved to Miami. The 26-year-old woman agreed to meet Aaron on the beach one afternoon with a group of his friends. He seemed standoffish, almost shy, and spent much of the time on his phone. But Elon, meanwhile, told her she'd be a nice addition to the family, things like that, she remembers. I literally fell for it. In October 2017, she joined Aaron at a restaurant with a big group, as well as a launch event for a new building co-hosted by Oren's boss, Douglas Elliman Chairman Howard Lorber. Once again, Oren barely spoke all evening, but it wasn't that late when he asked her back to his place for a glass of wine. She'd hardly had anything to drink, but she enjoyed wine and thought he might finally open up to her a little. When she entered his living room, the first thing she noticed were the striking floor-to-ceiling windows, the same ones that had so impressed Jane Doe several months earlier. He offered her a drink, as well as a virtual reality headset that allowed his clients to tour apartments remotely. Someone in Miami could check out a New York penthouse without hopping on a plane. Next photo. Shlomo and Orly Alexander attend the 2024 bond hearing for their twin sons. And, in an additional photo, Oren in 2020. While she had the goggles on, she was directed from the kitchen into an adjacent bedroom. Suddenly, without asking, Oren unzipped her dress down the back. She nervously told him she wasn't ready for that, but he pushed her onto the bed, forcibly flipped her around, and immediately penetrated her. I felt unheard, like I already voiced rejection, and now you didn't listen, she recounts. Instead of laughter and anxiety, I have anger and sadness. She remembers a feeling of physical powerlessness coming over her, like she'd taken anti-anxiety medication, though she hadn't knowingly done so. She began to sob. Stop crying, be quiet, you're ruining it, she recalls Oren saying. He knows what he's doing is wrong. There's no confusion at this point, she says to me. There was no misunderstanding. Afterward, she passed out. When she regained consciousness, she was still naked. Oren was back to his weird, awkward self and ordered her an Uber. She spent the next day in her bedroom crying, feeling dirty and embarrassed, but also angry. She soon told her sister, who was her roommate at the time. When Oren asked her to hang out again 2 weeks later, the pair decided it would be a good opportunity for her to confront him. She turned up, planning to yell at him and give him a piece of my mind. Instead of apologizing, he tried to kiss her, and when she pushed him off, he started masturbating and ejaculated on her seconds later. Nothing I did helped the situation, she recalls thinking as she fled. I go home, and I'm as angry as I can ever be. When Oren heard she was telling people what had happened, she says he texted her to stop talking about it, or he would ruin her. This woman says she has shared her account with her husband, local police, and the FBI, but is also not pursuing a civil case. Other women who have spoken out have faced public harassment. Soon after the initial allegations against the brothers became public last June, an anonymous website sprang up, accusing several by name of extortion. A few months later, my own personal Instagram account, where I had exchanged messages with some of the sources for this story, but rarely used otherwise, was unexpectedly suspended. An email informed me that my account, or activity on it, had somehow breached Instagram's community standards of integrity. We don't allow people on Instagram to pretend to be someone well-known, a message on the app said. When I appealed to reopen my account with the help of Vanity Fair's social media team, Meta quickly reinstated it, but the same thing happened twice more. Eventually, someone at Meta told us that an imposter account had gotten itself verified as me, blue check and all, and had been cloning images from my real account. The whole episode started the day after I arrived in Miami. By around 2019, the high-end real estate market was rapidly morphing into a personality-led world where individual brokers and their teams, think million-dollar listing and selling sunset, often outshone the sometimes staid businesses that ultimately backed them. In the Alexander's case, that was the century-old Douglas Elliman, where Chairman Lorber had taken Tal and Oren under his wing, according to sources who worked at the firm. A rep for Lorber disputed this characterization, saying he had only supported the commercial efforts of the Alexander team in the same way he supported the efforts of other brokers at Elliman. Lorber left in October 2024. The company told the SEC that his retirement was not due to any disagreement with the company on any matter relating to the company's operations, policies, or practices. In 2022, the Alexanders decided to fly the nest, striking out with three other industry heavyweights, to found a firm called Official. The collective, the other partners were Nicole Oge, Andrew Wachtvogel, and Richard Jordan, hoped to target America's 0.01%. Tal and Oren were more interested in lining their own pockets than anything else, says one top Miami broker who knew them at Douglas Elliman. During the Alexanders' stratospheric rise, many of the brokers who encountered the brothers described their approach to deal-making as hyper-competitive, prompting envy and occasionally grudging respect, but very often deep distrust. They were maybe laser-focused on the chicks and less so on the partying, recalls one club promoter who encountered them often in New York, where they frequented venues like Marquee, One Oak, 10 June, and SL. Sometimes their presence was unwelcome. At one Malibu house party, the host recalls, several women approached him about Elon. That guy's got to go, he recalls them saying. He's a dirtbag. All they ever said to me. Elon was leaving anyway, the host says, so we didn't have to boot him. Yet their rise continued. Kanye West reportedly sought them out for a $14 million Miami apartment he bought Kim Kardashian as a surprise Christmas gift in 2018. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner apparently used them to buy a $24 million home in Indian Creek. Other reported clients splashed across tabloid and industry press included supermodel Adriana Lima, billionaire investor Daniel Sundheim, fashion mogul Tommy Hilfiger, music producer Timbaland, and the state of Qatar, which offered close to $100 million for the 20,000-square-foot Wildenstein family townhouse on New York's Upper East Side that would serve as a new consulate. The New York Post described it as the most expensive townhouse sale in New York history, but the deal fell apart within a year. Adam Newman, the Lazarus-like co-founder of WeWork, became a client when he wanted to offload his penthouse in New York's Gramercy Park neighborhood. Weeks after, Official listed it for about $30 million. In July 2023, Newman attended Tal's wedding to Ariel Kogut, a financial industry recruiter. She filed for divorce in New York early this year, according to her attorney, Dan Notz. Newman did not respond to Vanity Fair. Oren had gotten married only months before to Camila Hansen, the Brazilian model, who told Vogue that Oren had picked her up in a Vegas hotel by asking if she was lost. To date, Nobody has purchased the 2400 Miele coffee maker off their registry. Elon was the first of the brothers to marry in May 2020 to Shani Zigron, an Israeli model with whom he has two young children. As part of their registry, they solicited cash for an African safari. Then their world came crashing down. Just minutes after midday, in late January 2024, Elon's wife, Shani, answered the door at their four-bedroom home, where Range Rovers with license plates like A-Team 7 and A-Team 11 were sometimes parked outside. The process server handed over an envelope of documents. Inside was a summons for Elon, tied to civil suits in New York. Filed by two women, Kate Whiteman and Rebecca Mandel, neither of whom spoke to Vanity Fair. A month or so later, the same process server handed a similar envelope to Oren's wife, Camila, when she answered the door at a different waterfront home, which the Alexanders had bought a few years earlier for $10 million on nearby Lake Avenue. Before filing her lawsuit, Whiteman's attorney had sought a multi-million dollar settlement from the brothers, according to messages sent by the brothers and obtained by Vanity Fair. But they had balked, and the messages indicate the brothers had only been willing to consider a fraction of that. According to a submission from the Alexanders' legal team for a mediation process in the summer of 2022, Whiteman had sent messages to both Elon and Oren that showed what the brothers argued was consensual, mutual desire, including social invitations. Elon and Oren's attorneys at the time used screenshots of the communication to bolster their client's position during the mediation process. She and her original lawyer parted ways, and Whiteman ultimately pursued her claims in a public suit with a new attorney. Kate was not raped by some strangers in a dark alley. She was assaulted by actual brothers she knew and trusted. Whiteman's current attorney, Evan Torgan, wrote in a statement sent to Vanity Fair, adding that she knew that if she brought the lawsuit, she would be smeared because of those messages, but she went forward anyway because she knew that she wasn't alone and that there were other victims as well. Under the pressure of these two lawsuits, Elon and Oren hired Jim Ferraro, a seasoned Miami trial attorney who more than a decade earlier had purchased two adjacent Manhattan penthouses for more than $15 million in deals brokered by Oren after meeting him skiing in Aspen. The filings came at a time of increased family tension as Oren and Tal started charting separate paths. Tal in New York was dedicated to individual transactions, while Oren in Miami was increasingly focused on long-term gains from developments outside of officials' day-to-day operations. Tal's revenues were consistently outstripping Oren's, with sales figures of around $50 million a month in his city's super prime market. For much of 2023 and early 2024, the brothers had not often seen eye to eye and had lost out on major opportunities, including a potential transaction involving Jeff Bezos, leaving Tal frustrated, according to messages he sent obtained by Vanity Fair. He had even considered making changes to the partnership between himself and Oren. Tal did not respond to requests for comment about this period. In early May 2024, Oren and Ohad Fisherman, Jane Doe's third alleged assailant, sold a Bay Harbor Islands penthouse for $11.25 million. And Oren began to feel hopeful about successfully confronting the allegations. Though a trade publication, The Real Deal, by then knew about the lawsuits, it had not yet reported on them, Oren told several people, and he was confident he could persuade The Real Deal's publisher, Amir Karanji, to spike a story. Karanji explained to Vanity Fair that he has in the past held information if it could lead to a bigger scoop, But this was different. "You're not understanding the situation," he recalls telling Oren. "I'm not trying to trade some celebrity buying a house in Miami for you guys raping people. This is not a trade that we're doing." Oren later threatened he would encourage the site's advertisers to leave, and subsequently vowed to sue the publication, according to Karanji. But then, a reporter at The Real Deal reached out about the lawsuits to an executive at Side, the business that provided Official with its support technologies and held the Alexander's brokerage license. Side is now suing Oren and Tal in a California court for defaulting on a loan they had used to set up Official. Until then, Oren had barely mentioned the case to anyone, including his parents. He was in the Bahamas with his wife Camila, pregnant with their first child, when he first told her about the lawsuits. Camila told him she was glad he hadn't settled, according to messages sent by Oren. On June 8th, The Real Deal dropped the bombshell. Oren told business associates he felt like passing out and cried on several phone calls with friends and clients. Though he couldn't seem to tear himself away from the devastating commentary on Instagram, messages he sent at the time suggest he was also still bullish about his ability to respond to what he and his brothers considered a witch hunt. Justice would prevail, and Oren would be exonerated. That night, he and Camila shared dinner, looking out over the Atlantic, at a table lit by tiki torches, with a single pink rose in a small glass vase. June ended up being the strongest month in the two-year history of Official, with closed sales totaling $150 million. But Oren's personal brand was spiraling with knock-on effects. Official listed a $55 million property in Golden Beach on June 13th. Then the seller decided to switch agents. Oren canceled on a real estate journalist from London who was supposed to tour the $800 million Dolce & Gabbana Tower in Brickell, where apartments started at $3.5 million. Official soon lost that business, too. Oren spent $25,000 to put a crisis communications firm on retainer and, in short order, publicly stepped back from Official, which he announced on Instagram, naturally. Oren told people he wanted to hire a social media forensic investigator to uncover what he was sure was a concerted effort by his competitors to take him down. He considered hiring defamation lawyers to sue The Real Deal and said he spoke to more than half a dozen lawyers about representation, including a former prosecutor from the Southern District of New York, where his federal case will be prosecuted, as well as someone from Black Cube, the Israeli intelligence firm that Harvey Weinstein hired to investigate Ronan Farrow during his dogged reporting for The New Yorker. Oren even told people he planned to hold a party for his supporters once the cases were eventually dismissed. But by then, female employees across Official were expressing concerns. And in a message shared with his Official colleagues, Tal called his brother's actions, as described in the first two lawsuits, reprehensible. What happens is you become so effing magical that you just become, in your mind, invincible, said one of Miami's top brokers, using nuke to describe the Alexander's reputational collapse. Sometimes the wicked ass comes back to effing haunt you. Tal told people his wife, Ariel, would start some days in tears. Though Tal insisted to anyone who would listen that his brothers had done nothing wrong, he was still worried national newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times would pick up the story, which they did. A trickle became a torrent as more women filed lawsuits over the summer. Officials' agents across the country, from the Hamptons to Aspen, Los Angeles to Miami, began evaluating their options, worried about the firm's survival. One client after another dropped the firm, whose death was swift, says Jim, the California broker. It practically happened overnight, and that was one of the most promising brokerages that had ever been conceived and put together in the history of brokerage in this country, he says. They had all the right people, they were targeting all the right geographies, and had hired all the right agents. Tal and Oren, the top two earners, were no longer on the books, but still hoped to control its assets, even as the company's other founders fought to keep it alive without them, while supporting the workforce. None of this stopped Oren from holidaying in southern France and Ibiza with Camila and their friends, while Tal spent tens of thousands a month on a Hamptons rental, working out at Barry's boot camp and eating soft serve ice cream with Ariel, who, like Camila, was pregnant by then. In a statement to Vanity Fair, Camila Hansen, Oren's wife, said it was unfortunate that in today's world a man can be falsely accused and people are quick to believe it without question, declaring that these accusations are completely false. One woman, who says Oren raped her, remembers watching his seemingly inescapable rise in Miami in the years after her encounter, with marketing campaigns and magazines linking his name to $30 million homes. He's got all the friends, and he's got the boats and the houses and the hot Brazilian model girlfriend, and it's like, wow, God is really blessing this guy, she thought. It made me feel like the world was unfair. Following her own experience, she says she learned of several other accounts, and then the pair of civil suits became public last year. I guess karma does eventually win. At some point last year, the FBI began monitoring the brothers' phone calls and obtaining access to accounts for their iClouds, social media, and dating apps. These contained explicit photos and videos, some of which Oren had made, depicting the twins' sexual activity, prosecutors said, with at least one identified victim. Further evidence showed them arranging travel and drugs for young women, as well as discussing group sex. One group that discussed imports of the women and the cost of their flights to Tulum, as well as mentions of G, which investigators believe was a reference to GHB, a well-known date rape drug. It was still dark on December 11, 2024, when the FBI and Miami Beach SWAT teams gathered for a 5 a.m. briefing in the parking lot of a Miami Beach golf course. Not long after, dozens of figures in tactical gear and others in blue and yellow federal windbreakers appeared at Oren's and Alon's homes, ready to begin their raids. The brothers were roused from their beds, their hands placed in zip ties by Miami Beach police officers, their property searched by FBI teams who seized cell phones, cameras, computers, and external hard drives. Tal had flown down to Miami the night before, apparently unaware of the impending storm when he'd arrived with Ariel. The pair slept at his parents' place in Bell Harbor, inside a gated community guarded by his father's security business. As his brothers' homes were raided, investigators from the Florida State Attorney's Office, which had opened its own case, took up position outside the Alexander parents' house, stopping Shlomi as he left the house. They asked him to call Tal outside. Once cuffed, Tal was driven in a Bell Harbor police cruiser to the makeshift command post at the same golf course parking lot, where his cuffs were swapped and the FBI took custody. All three brothers were charged by the feds with sex trafficking offenses, while Alon and Oren were charged with state crimes, including against Jane Doe. Over the next several weeks, the brothers made substantial offers to the government for bond, including more than $115 million in one hearing, One of the defense attorneys, Milton Williams, said the proposal meant their family members were willing to give up basically everything that they have if the defendants were to attempt to flee while on bail. A spokesperson for all three brothers told Vanity Fair that they would have run if they wanted to. Alon's wife has been photographed arriving at a bail hearing in Florida, and both parents have been in court frequently, but otherwise, says a friend, nobody's associating with the twins right now. Some victims said no or stop. Others screamed, reads a letter from federal prosecutors to judges. But the defendants did not stop. They ignored their victims' distress, their obvious unwillingness to engage in sexual activity. Prosecutors argue the three brothers still represent a real and present danger to their communities, and noted that government investigators learned from phone taps that Oren had spoken to another U.S. citizen under separate criminal scrutiny who had fled to Israel. In mid-January, a federal judge in New York denied bail for Alon, Oren, and Tal. Even with the brothers behind bars, for now, many women remain afraid to talk. He basically knows literally all my information, down to my Social Security, according to one woman. They are evil people, she wrote to Vanity Fair. Sorry, just can't risk my safety. For those victims who are willing to talk, the arrests have been a mixed blessing. It's a little late, says one of the high school accusers. They were able to really enjoy life and enjoy all the stuff that they were doing. But better now than never. They deserve it. For Jane Doe, ever since that life-altering afternoon in Miami Beach, she has unraveled, say family and friends. Jane initially decided not to report the incident to police, believing the Alexanders were too powerful and frightened they might react with further violence. After she moved to Miami for work months later, Alon had walked past her in a coffee shop, betraying no hint of recognition, she says. A co-worker watched as she suffered a panic attack. She was shopping with her mom at a Target in June last year when one of her sisters texted a link to a news report about the civil suits. Another wave of panic consumed her. Despite sometimes numbing depression, her difficulties trusting men, and the other emotional scars from her painful secret, years of therapy have helped her work toward the conclusion that she's done nothing wrong. It took a while to realize that it wouldn't have mattered who they would have done this to. They've done it, obviously, to multiple people, she says now. I understand that it was not my fault.
Thank you.
Air of Danger. Fancy flyers have created a huge boom in private jet travel. No longer the exclusive province of Fortune 500 companies, Elon Musk or Taylor Swift. Yet for all the allure, flying private is a rather dangerous luxury. By Jeff Wise. Opening illustration shows a jet taxiing down the runway. They called her Gypset. The name, a combination of gypsy and jet set, wasn't one she'd come up with herself. She'd gotten it from the writer Julia Chaplin, who coined the term in her 2009 book Gypset Style to evoke the vibe of bright young things who waft from Sayulita to Tangier to Topanga Canyon, crafting eclectic necklaces and draping yurts with Hermes cashmere, athletic and glamorously bohemian, with glacial blue eyes and a silver ring in her nose. Gypset embodied her nickname's ideal, always flying off to go skiing or hang out backstage at a rock show. Her given name was Lindsay Gleisch. She lived in Huntington Beach, California, a short walk to the Pacific Surf. Being a gypset is an occupation best suited for the independently wealthy, and Gleisch wasn't that. She had a normal job designing websites for Dollar General, but she was beautiful, friendly, and free-spirited. In mid-2022, when she was 30, Gleisch met a man 5 years her junior, Reese Linders, on a ski trip to Mammoth. Linders was a pilot who was building his flight experience in turboprops and small jets. He took her on jaunts to Las Vegas to see shows, to Arizona for her birthday, to the Bay Area for more music. It was an intense but short-lived relationship. The two called it quits in spring 2023, but they continued to see each other occasionally, as exes sometimes do. On a Friday night in July, Gleisch was in her apartment, getting ready to have dinner by herself when her phone rang. It was Linders. He was about to take a spur-of-the-moment flight to Las Vegas with two older couples. The relationship was personal and professional. Linders was working for Manuel Vargas, but the two were also friends. Perhaps that's why Linders was allowed to ask Gleisch if she wanted to tag along. They could make a night of it, hit some bars, and then fly home. What did she think? She said yes right away. It was a nearly 2-hour drive across the mountains to get to French Valley, the airstrip Linders was departing from, a slog, but better than sitting at home on a Friday night. The plane, a white Cessna Citation II jet with red and tan speed stripes, took off at 9:18 p.m. from the exurbs on the far side of the coastal mountains. Linders, the pilot in command, sat in the front left seat. To his right was his co-pilot, 32-year-old Vargas. Vargas had a successful real estate and landscaping business and flew helicopters, jets, and prop planes for both business and pleasure. He and his wife, Abby, had 5 kids, ranging in age from 1 to 14, and lived in a sprawling compound in Temecula. Abby was sitting in the back of the plane with Gleisch and the other couple, Alma, 51, and Abe Razik, 48. The Raziks had 7 kids and owned several car dealerships in California and Arizona. The plane touched down at 10:04 p.m. at Harry Reid International Airport, and the group headed north to the Strip. Gleisch and Linders made their way to the Alley Lounge on 66, a wood-paneled bar in the Conrad Hotel at Resorts World. Linders had a drink, but by FAA regulation, he shouldn't have had any. Gleisch was under no such restrictions, and by the time the group headed back to the airport, she was buzzed enough to be over the DUI limit. So were Manny and Abby Vargas. The Raziks had enough alcohol in them to be on the verge of passing out. At 3:04 a.m., while they were waiting to take off, Gleisch texted her friend Lindsay Mausner a picture she'd taken looking out over the strip. Love that someone's awake, because Vegas also never sleeps, Gleisch wrote cryptically. On the East Coast, Mausner wasn't awake, though, and the text she read in the morning marked the last time she ever heard from her friend. Flying private has always held an edgy allure. It is a true satanic temptation, as former Vanity Fair editor Tina Brown recently declared in her Substack. I am convinced it's the single most seductive experience in the world, she wrote. You realize there is no one you wouldn't kill, betray, or sleep with to ensure a lifetime of lux relief from the armpit of mass transit. Personally owned or chartered jets are potent signifiers of over-the-top wealth, redolent of exclusivity and power. Yet they evoke all of the darker aspects of that privilege. There's no better way to encapsulate your status in 30 seconds of cell phone video than to show yourself sliding into a Gulfstream at Teterboro and sliding out at Ibiza's private jet terminal. You'll also be embodying extreme inequality and destroying the environment. And over the past few years, owing in part to the pandemic, PJs have morphed from a mysterious elite privilege into an object of popular fascination and marginally more widespread accessibility. Where commercial aviation has been making headlines for all of its chaos and agita, PJs seem to offer freedom and comfort. And though they were once mainly tasked with shuttling executives around, jets are now used by wealthy individuals like the family station wagon. It's all about the creature comforts that Mr. and Mrs. Hedge Fund have grown accustomed to, one aircraft broker told me. These jets are being marketed as pied-à-terre in the sky. They are also unmistakable markers of status. Anyone can flaunt a Dior bag or splurge on a dinner at Per Se, but if your ride is a Gulfstream, you are the real thing. When Donald Trump isn't flying Air Force One, a modified 747 jumbo jet, he flies a 757 with his name painted on the side. Elon Musk flies multiple Gulfstreams and is famously touchy about the fact that they are publicly tracked. Taylor Swift owns a Dassault Falcon, but also charters other jets. Former Google CEO Eric Schmidt enjoys his Gulfstream so much that on average, he flies more than once per day and spends one-sixth of his total time flying. Next photo, Free Spirit. Lindsay Mausner and Lindsay Gleisch attend a Goose concert on December 17, 2022, in Broomfield, Colorado. Celebrities love to flex on TikTok with images of themselves sitting on jets. A subtler way to signal your belonging is to drop the name of one of the FBOs, or fixed base operators, providing lounges and concierge service at private aviation terminals, such as Million Air, Signature, and Jet Aviation. There is no greater hazard than the offer of a Gulfstream to foster dubious associations, Brown wrote in her newsletter, mentioning the private jet usage of the Obamas, the late Barbara Walters, and former President Bill Clinton. Now publicly remorseful, he partook of Jeffrey Epstein's plane, as did Trump. The one thing flying private doesn't offer is more safety. In most things, the ultra-rich are much more protected than the rest of us. They even live longer. But when it comes to air travel, those who fly private are actually at a significant disadvantage. The collision of an American Airlines jet and an Army helicopter in Washington, D.C. in January was the first fatal commercial crash in the United States on a domestic carrier since 2009. Meanwhile, fatal private jet crashes happen 3 times a year on average in the United States, with most of them killing everyone on board, according to a federal accident database. The terms private jet and business jet refer to any turbine engine aircraft that isn't used for scheduled airline flights, with most such aircraft being smaller than regional jets and seating between 4 and 19 passengers. So far, 2025 has been unusually deadly. The crash of a medevac jet in Philadelphia on January 31st killed all six aboard and one on the ground. On February 10th, a private jet belonging to Motley Crue's Vince Neil careened into a larger business jet in Scottsdale, Arizona, killing the pilot. Why is the jet set life, with all its promise of exclusivity and freedom, so much more hazardous? The answer is related to how wealthy people are allowed to take investment risk that average people aren't. Because they are considered sophisticated, it's assumed that they understand the hazards and can bear the consequences. Likewise, if you have your own plane, you're in a position to check for yourself and gauge whether it is safe. Commercial passengers, by contrast, can't be expected to assess the safety of their air carrier. The job of the Federal Aviation Administration is to protect the unknowing public, says Fred Lee, a former pilot who conducts seminars about air charter operations with the agency, which is responsible for regulating all non-military aviation in the United States. Though the military does follow FAA rules when operating in national airspace. Sophisticated customers, in other words, are expected to understand the dangers so the rules can be looser. If they make a dumb decision, that's on them. The thing is, if you give people the opportunity to make bad decisions, it won't be long before some of them do. In March 2023, Dana Hyde and her husband, Jonathan Chambers, took their teenage son, Elijah, on a two-day trip to New England to look at colleges. The pair were something of a Washington power couple. Hyde, 55, was a lawyer who worked in the Obama White House and then was tapped to head the Millennium Challenge Corporation, a government-funded development agency. Chambers was a former Federal Communications Commission official who wrote rules there for cable TV providers, then left to join a consulting company. Driving to New Hampshire would have taken 8 hours, but Chambers' company had a corporate jet, a super mid-size class Bombardier Challenger 300 that comfortably sat up to 9 passengers. Another well-known Bombardier aficionado is Swift, who frequently flies on a Bombardier Global 6000. The model had a good safety record, but the pilots had limited experience in the aircraft type. Each having less than 100 hours of flying time in it. Normally, if one guy's a newbie, you'd want to have one guy with at least 100 hours, says Mark Beaumont, a retired pilot who flew Citation jets. But if you don't have that luxury, and it's allowable within the regulations, well, that's what you've got. As a private pilot myself, I can attest that becoming fluent in all of the nuances of a particular aircraft is very helpful for safety and takes time to master. Next photo, high tragedy. A field near the landing approach at French Valley Airport in Murrieta, California, where a Cessna crashed on July 8, 2023, killing all six passengers. Inexperienced pilots have become a prominent hazard of flying private. The surge in PJ popularity has run headlong into a conflicting trend, a shortage of skilled pilots. The military trains far fewer aviators than it once did, and fewer young people dream of the skies. Meanwhile, airlines have raised salaries, luring pilots from smaller operators. The situation has been years in the making, and it is incredibly challenging, says Cheryl Barden, CEO of the recruiting agency Aviation Personnel International. You can't make a pilot overnight, and we didn't make them for so long, and now we have a big gap. Pilots who once would have happily spent their careers flying private jets are instead getting pulled up into the airlines as soon as they've logged the required number of hours, leaving behind those with less stick time, and that has safety implications. It's like a teenager driving your car, says Barden. You've had so much more experience, and that gives you situational awareness and knowledge. That doesn't mean every teenage driver is a bad driver. They just don't have the same level of experience. A large proportion of private jet accidents in recent years have involved careless piloting of a type that is rarely seen in commercial aviation. In 2021, the pilots of a Challenger landing in Truckee, California, rushed their landing unnecessarily, lost control of their airspeed, and corkscrewed into the ground. Almost 2 months later, a Citation crashed while trying to take off from Farmington, Connecticut, because the pilot forgot to disengage the parking brake. In January 2023, an Embraer Phenom light jet veered off the center line during takeoff, wobbled in midair, and crashed after hurrying to depart from Provo, Utah, before a snowstorm, killing the pilot. As Hyde and her family readied for takeoff from Dillon Hopkins Airport in Keene, New Hampshire, on March 3, 2023, their pilots gave off hints that they weren't fully on the ball. According to the preliminary accident report, during the standard pre-flight inspection, they failed to notice a bright red cover had remained in place over the pitot tube, a probe that measures the aircraft's speed and whose malfunction famously caused an Air France crash over the Atlantic in 2009. Only after they'd started accelerating down the runway for takeoff did they see that their speed wasn't registering on the instrument panel. They aborted the takeoff, and the captain got out to remove the cover. The second takeoff attempt was successful, and the plane climbed as it headed south. But just 2 minutes into the flight, the control panel began to light up with a slew of warnings, including AP stab trim fail and AP holding nose down. The pilots didn't fully understand what was happening, but the system designed to even out aerodynamic forces in the plane's tail wasn't operating correctly, and so the pilot was struggling to hold the plane's nose down. Over the next 6 minutes, the plane continued to climb as the pilots struggled to figure out what was going on. In emergencies, pilots are trained to refer to checklists that give step-by-step instructions of what to do. Unfortunately, in this case, the co-pilot pulled the wrong one. Its first item was to disengage the autopilot, but when they did that, the nose shot up, like a tug-of-war contestant whose opponent had suddenly dropped the rope. Alarmed, the pilots pushed the nose back down again, then jerked it back up again when the plane plunged too steeply. Back in the passenger cabin, Chambers was strapped into his seat, but Hyde wasn't. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman. Today's program is in memory of my papa, my grand-mère.